You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
So I'll give you a little inside baseball as to how we do this. One of the things we wanted to do is we did the vote, and you know, thanks for the 250, 300 of you, however many it was, who voted on Twitter and Facebook for Indiana Jones Month. And then I was like, oh, there's an extra one in November. Let's pick a movie that's similar. Well, should we do a sequel to a movie we already did, like National Treasure? I'm like, nah, let's do something a little bit different. So I was like, oh, there's that weird Disney movie that I saw in theaters about a, you know, Indiana Jones era person who discovers Atlantis, I think. I think it's Michael J. Fox even. Well, that should be a fun romp. Turns out this is more like the movie's Stargate that we did earlier. But wow, this is a weird Disney movie. I'm just going to, if you haven't seen it, stop it now. It's on Netflix. Just enjoy. But anyway, next month we go Muppets, as we kind of allude to at the end of this episode. But we thought we should do some family entertainment because that's kind of the nature of the show. But also, nothing is warm and softer than a kind of nice family movie with the Muppets. It's silly. So we picked some weird ones. Don't worry, Jim Henson's Dark Side is out. But anyway, Cineprov has two shows in December. I'm going to be doing the like Destroying Family or Childhood Memories episode, which is a bunch of shorts. But they're also doing a Christmas movie, which should not have existed. And with that in mind, thanks. Oh, please rate and review us. And I haven't mentioned it in a few weeks, but ESO Patreon, we occasionally put stuff out there, and I hope it picks up. But thanks, guys. You've supported us, and now we enter the last month of the year. But thanks for making 2018 so incredible. Bye.
Hey gang, are you looking for another podcast to listen to? Well, you're in luck. The Nerdy Laser is a podcast, and we specialize in 90s nerd culture. But we don't leave anything out. If something is cool and nerdy, we will talk about it. So join myself, Richard Yule, and a variety of guests on the Nerdy Laser podcast, available on iTunes, Podbean, and the ESO Network.
Welcome to my movie to defend your childhood. This week, we do the only Disney movie that I took on a date and turned out to be a mistake. Atlantis, : The Lost Empire. I'm Nick Hoffman, host of my movie to defend your childhood and award-winning comedian, so f*** all of you. Panel, we have...
No, thank you, Nick. Matthew W. Quinn, horror writer.
And sexually rejecting me.
Yes, I am.
Charlie Rose.
And...
Instead of a quippy pun, I've got a question. When you say it was a mistake, are you referring to the movie or the date?
So, I have some date stories, but this one in particular, when I was in high school, this is 2002, 2001?
2001.
Somewhere around there.
It's before 9/11.
Whoa.
So, I was going on a 9/11 date, and this just fell completely apart. No, I was in a movie theater with some friends of mine, and we wanted to watch a Disney movie, and we were kind of giggling at some of the bad stuff, but a woman behind us was with her daughter, a young kid, maybe 10, and they're like, I'm so impressed. You guys were such good, clean, or whatever, like upstanding, like polite kids, and I'm just like...
Well, we're never doing that again.
Yeah, we're never doing that again. So the next date movie I went to was Out Cold with Zach Galifianakis, and... We were the only ones in the theater, which is helpful on a date.
Oh, that's when you get to play games of tag or other fun games if it's a date night.
Ooh.
Yeah, tag. We played tag. Let's go with
yeah,
tag.
Yeah, okay, that's...
You've never done that in an empty theater, played a nice game of tag?
On yeah, when I was in
date?
High school on a date.
Not on a date.
Okay, okay, okay.
Dates, you get to do some other stuff.
Certain parts of me were tagged. So, but we're talking about Atlantis, the Lost Empire, and with that in mind... I don't even know where to start with this movie. It was here. It was my selection because after doing a month of Indiana Jones movies, I thought I hadn't seen this in a while. But it's so bad that Disney offered it up for Netflix. So that's step one. That tells you what they thought of it, I guess. Because they're like, this isn't worth charging people for. We're going to charge people for everything.
You talk about offering up for sacrifice. Now I'm thinking of, Kali Ma.
Shucky Day. Kali Ma, Shucky Day, buddy.
Kali Ma. Kali Ma.
Well, this whole thing is about the heart of Atlantis and them trying to take it.
Need to set up a YouTube channel for your impressions. You're good. Seriously.
Oh, thank you. Maybe I will at some point in the future.
You need to do that meme where it's Darth Vader bowing down before Mickey Mouse, the Emperor. That would be hilarious.
Good. Ha! Huh? Let the anger flow through you.
Okay, say the words.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
Mickey Mouse.
Feels so
right.
Dirty.
I own your sorry ass, Anakin. Ha ha.
I have the higher ground. Ha ha. Well, this is where we're starting right now. Just a bunch of Mickey Mouse impressions.
Because here's the problem. I mean, this isn't even behind the lens anymore. The way we start these movies are we order a shitload of bad pizza, we drink some beers, and we're like, so what are we going to talk about? And we agreed, there's not a lot to talk about in this movie.
Can I just mention that Father Guido Sarducci is in this movie, and he's not playing Father Guido Sarducci?
Well, I mean,
can we start there?
Jim Varney's in it, not playing Ernest. Michael J. Fox is supposed to hold the movie together, and he does, frankly, a fine job, but he has nothing to do. No one has anything to do in this movie.
I thought the part where the Board of Trustees of the museum are all running away from him was hilarious.
That's 4 seconds, though. I mean, and you're right.
Walker's laughing the whole time.
I'm not arguing with you that it's a good part, but the movie has no idea what it's doing. And, like, for a Disney movie, of all the movies we've done by Disney, and we've done a few of them, this is the one that feels the most done by committee.
Yeah.
Like, well...
Well, I can tell what the initial idea was, because it feels like Journey to the Center of the Earth. That's basically the plot. It's this team that goes to Iceland to find some lost mythic land, which is the same plot as that book, which works great for a kid's movie, because, a lot of kids I know I did, that's how they get into genre stuff, is by Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, which it's great to mine, but then Disney just goes completely off the rails and just does not care about making anything quality.
It goes to full-blown diesel punk territory, which is kind of cool.
Well, yes. Okay, so Disney's entry into the whole idea of they were inspired by Jules Verne, it's Hollow Earth, it's steampunk, it's all these elements that could have made for a fantastic movie. I think that it's also one of Disney's more mature, non-musical movies. And whenever they try to do that in an animated form, it falls flat. Mm-hmm. Black Cauldron?
Yeah, yeah. Mature. I mean, the pretty substantial body count here.
Oh, yeah. Body count was ridiculous.
Well, and to your point, would it need it then if they were going to go this way? Or jokes?
Like, yeah.
Because I'm thinking of Emperor's New Groove. Like, there's no songs in that. Except for Cusco. But the thing about the rest of the movie is it's funny.
Yeah.
This is the driest. Like, that's why I thought it would be good, because we start on a cold open of Michael J. Fox figuring it out.
Yeah, well, it starts with the destruction of Atlantis, which was apparently hit by a, quote, cool glowy thingy. And, like, only the town center survives and it's underwater.
Yeah,
a Disney princess movie where we actually see her mom for all about 5 minutes.
Well, we rarely see in a Disney movie how that one parent dies. And so here we go. We see the parent. Not since The Lion King has someone been so interestingly killed. Oh, wait. Never mind. The Lion King was good. This is not.
Ooh.
This could have used a little bit of Elton John. At least that's...
that special touch that only he can bring.
I don't know.
Something. Anything. This needed a special touch.
I'm picturing more Annie Lennox, considering the look.
You know, you said Journey to the Center of the Earth, and that's in my notes, which don't exist. But the rock version. Have you seen the Journey to the Center of the Earth?
No, I've not. It's good stuff.
It is, because it's stupid fun.
Yes, exactly.
This is too thinky-think. If you told me this was done by Aaron Sorkin, I'd believe you, because it's all talking. Everything is talking. People are talking about how they talked the scene before when they were talking.
This is clearly not an Aaron Sorkin thing. Nobody's getting high off the fact that they exist.
No one's walking while talking. They're all standing still while they're talking.
Well, here's the thing. When you're watching the movie, the first part of it, before they actually reach Atlantis, there were lots of humorous moments. There's lots of comedy. There's some physical comedy. There's some slapstick comedy. There's a little bit of thinking comedy. But I found more comedy in the first half than I did in the second half. Right. And the second half went completely like moral study and, you know, colonialism. And I think that's where it fell apart. There was no comedy.
I just remember a lot of racist jokes against French people. That's the only comedy I remember.
No, but hey, that's Jim Varney. That's when Guido Sarducci's talking. We got six of these, but we would need 100, and I made some of them.
The plucky ethnic stereotype brigade,
which is what this movie is. It's
well, and here's the thing. Again, that's why I thought Indiana Jones, but there's no charm here except for... This might be the most... Okay, let me start again. The problem is, when we're talking about filmmaking, this might be the most interesting study in bad filmmaking. Because if you see a great movie, I don't know, the first one we talked about in the Indiana Jones series is Raiders of the Lost Ark. It might be a masterpiece in a lot of ways, but you have great directing, great acting, great music, great filmography, great cinematography, great set design. In a movie like that, how do you pick out what deserves the Academy Award? Is it the great scenery? Because it's all practical. Is it the great direction? What's the difference between directing and producing that movie? It's hard to pick apart. And so when you're giving the Academy Award, if Spielberg wins directing but it doesn't win Best Picture, you're okay with it because it's all good. In this movie, it picks it apart because the voice acting is spectacular. When Jim Varney as the cook speaks, it's hilarious. When Father Guido Sarducci, whose name I'm not even going to bother to learn, when he's Father Guido Sarducci, is the bomb expert, his dialogue is atrocious. It's bad. He's hilarious.
Yeah, his delivery is really funny. That weird Italian monotone.
Well,
thing.
That's the way. That's what the character was.
Who he is. No, when he goes off talking about how he's going to open up his flower shop and that what days it's going to be open, I was just that's comedy right there. It was great. More of that, please.
And there's this stupid scene. It's literally the worst cheesy scene a writer can write. It's like, so give us all your backstories. What is your backstory? And he's like, so my parents had a flower shop. And so the flower shop. So there I was making like 400 corsages. And I was like, does the blue match my dress? And then I decided to burn it all down.
Did they have a prom in the 1914 America?
They absolutely did.
Oh, okay.
But the thing
I
is...
I thought it was an anachronism.
No, it's absolutely not. Because we've put women in white dresses and forced them to dance forever. It's called cotillion.
All right, now I've got a question. We're going on and on about the comedic sensibilities of this film. So this is literally a line from this movie.
Go on.
Tonight's supper will be baked beans. A musical program will follow. You.
I thought that was funny.
That was.
You would, Matt.
Yes, I would.
I did chuckle at that one.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why.
Give in, Charlie. Join the dark side.
But here's the thing. Daniel's right. He can't act. But it works because the woman who gives it pitches it as though she's done. Right?
Yeah.
No, you're not wrong. It's a terrible line. The movie is filled with terrible lines, including Michael J. Fox explaining how he happens to know how a boiler works, which he does 4 times in this movie. And guess what? I get it, buddy. You twist some knobs and hit it with a wrench. I've seen bad bondage porn. But...
Oh, my.
All right.
But the rest of it is all... based on whether the voice actor can pitch it. And frankly, everyone showed up with their tucks and tails and said, I'm in a Disney movie. this movie doesn't deserve half these people. It doesn't. It really doesn't. Because, like, when Cookie, as Jim Varney, who at this point is literally 2 years from death.
I think this is his last movie.
It is.
He didn't see it premiere.
He didn't see. So it's not even 2 years. It's probably 9 months from his death. He's like, I got you some grub. And he's scratching his gut. And you know, in the studio, he's got a whiskey straight and he's scratching his gut. It's done.
Yeah, you can envision these people.
Well, I mean, amongst the other star power in this movie, though, is a woman from Maniac Cop 2 as one of the main villains.
So
she's the best.
So yeah. the German girl?
Yes.
You talking about Claudia Christian?
Yes.
Yeah, she's been in other stuff.
Wait, Claudia Christian from Farscape?
No, it's Claudia Black.
Yes.
Whoa.
Sorry, I went full nerd. I apologize.
No. I was correcting Matt because you just got nerd done.
Am I well done or medium rare?
You're the whitest person I know, so I'm going to say you're medium rare.
But Charlie, remember that Rick and Morty with Claudia Black and Virginia Hay?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
But no, Claudia Christian, she was in Babylon 5. She's amazing.
She's good.
Wrong sci-fi franchise.
Sudsy, just catch us up with the plot.
Okay, well, I mean, it's a standard adventure plot. There's this nebbish wannabe historian, Michael J. Fox, who I've already forgotten these people's names.
Milo Thatch.
Okay. All right, cool. Well,
the porn version is Milo Snatch, by the way, since we're doing that.
All right, cool. Funnier joke than anything in this movie, but anyway.
You take that back, sir.
No. He's convinced that the... thought concept, thought riddle that Plato put forth of the lost continent of Atlantis was describing the actual thing.
Yeah.
So he's trying to get backers to find it, and he eventually gets it from some guy that knew his grandfather who was equally obsessed with finding Atlantis.
Yeah, Whitmore.
Whitmore,
yes. So they put a team together of a bunch of ethnic stereotypes to go down, find Atlantis, and...
I'm going to need 12 guys.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, we have an Elliot Gould showing up. He's like, you're going to need 12 guys. And we're going to put it together. We're going to find Atlantis. My Elliot Gould got a little bit southern at the end there, and I apologize. I mean, you're dead on.
Thought experiment, by the way, I think was the phrase I was looking for in that plot synopsis. But
yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Atlantis isn't real, and especially not in the conspiracy theory, like put on a hat. I call it, when I'm talking to my students, I'm like, put on your aluminum hat for a second. Like, this is what we've got. And so, yeah, it's an ancient treasure. That's why I thought this would be a good movie to follow up our Indiana Jones month, which is that they're finding an ancient treasure. There's a guy who's a linguist. He's reading stuff, and he's like, aha, but this R in Ireland should have been a C for Iceland.
Speaking of which, a linguist that's obsessed with finding a lost civilization. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it's Noam Chomsky looking for hope.
Yes, yeah. Basically.
Whackety smackety doo.
Again, funnier joke than anything in this movie.
Was he a cunning linguist?
Gross.
Oh, that's about on par with the jokes in this movie.
That joke is orally disappointing. here's the thing. You're right. He's a loser looking for Atlantis, and then we have this montage of maps to prove he's knowledgeable. All of this is boring nothingness, man. Like, the problem with this movie to me is not that it's put together poorly. It's Disney. It's put together by committee, because it's all like... Well, if he's in charge of a university, why doesn't he talk to other people? And, what if he's a loser? He's actually like a janitor type. And nothing feels organic. It just feels like it's all studio notes.
Plus, you could tell some of the characters and some of the settings were made just to sell action figures. So, like, the ship that they're taking down was probably a toy set at some point.
Yeah, because the submarine is only in the movie for about 5 or 10 minutes and gets slagged.
Yeah, there you go.
And so, like, when Whitmore comes out and it's the dad from Frasier, again, a good voice actor, yep, who's over the top, and he's like, I've been around the world, so even though it's pre-World War I, I'm doing, like, yoga and stuff. And
I did like that. That is one bit of this movie that I did like, was the build-up to meeting him and then actually meeting him when they're on the elevator. It's like going, okay, you'll refer to him as Mr. Whitmore, sir. You will not make eye contact with him. You will not speak unless he speaks first. And then you meet him, and he's just this old crank doing yoga.
Well, and again, we really haven't gotten into these characters, but what's her name? Olga?
Helga.
Helga. Helga. And, like, and she talks as though she's doing Kegel exercises the whole time. Like, like the rod is so far up that she's sharpening it like a pencil. Like,
she's basically Ilsa from Indiana Jones if she was a lot meaner.
I mean, like, it's like so dry. And, like, again, you don't look at the professor. You don't make eye contact. And he's just a chill guy doing his flexing. Mm-hmm. And he's like, so I knew your grandfather. And it turns out that not only was he a real guy, but I knew what he was talking about, and he sent you this. He sent you this plot device, and I'm going to the Shepherd's Journal.
Shepherd's Journal,
and it is the way to get to the Lost City of Atlanta.
That was a good Futurama.
That was a great
episode.
Futurama skit.
Well, if I recall correctly, it's written in Atlantean dialect.
Which
he can read, but apparently no one in Atlantis can, which becomes a plot point later somehow.
This is where it becomes like...
Did you notice that Atlantis' society rips off Zardoz's society?
Yeah, but without the crotch shots. Well, kind of.
Kind of.
I only hear Leonard Nimoy saying the gun is good and the penis is evil.
What I mean specifically...
I mean, yeah.
That is most logical. What I mean...
So the penis is good, right?
So continuing on, what were you saying?
What I mean specifically is the fact that everybody in the city is immortal and they're being kept alive by this giant crystal in the heart of the city.
Yeah, I mean...
Which is Zardoz.
I mean, I would say the better movie, but...
No.
The less Sean Connery movie is the one we're talking about. Also less crotch shots by about 30%. Yeah. But 30%, and that's all I'm going to give it. But then we enter the Journey to the Center of the Earth sequence, mm-hmm. where they fight after fighting a giant lobster, they end up on foot, they blow up some antiquities, they have
made a bridge that took, like, what, 10 seconds?
Oh, and Milo's, again, you said a nebbish. He's, I'm going to do Woody Allen because all I can do, because I can't do a Michael J. Fox, but it's almost a mile high. I mean, it must have taken 1,000 years, and, you know, I made a bridge. It took 6 seconds. Seven, but, you know.
You sound like this, one of those guys from Batman Returns.
Which guy?
The evil billionaire's son.
Chris Christopherson? No.
Chris, you mean Christopher Walken?
Chris Walken. Yeah, it's Chris Walken.
Wow. I tried putting out...
That's a roundabout way to get to Chris Walken.
I tried putting
so
out
So we need more cowbell?
Song.
Is that it?
Chris Walken versus Chris Christopherson. Oh my God, that'd be a knockdown, drag-out, bearded fight. I love it.
If anybody wants to do a cover of Me and Bobby McGee in the style of Christopher Walken, I will give you a quarter.
Nope. Me and Bobby McGee. Okay.
Freedom's another word for nothing left to lose.
Let me defend some excellent points about this movie, okay?
Please.
Okay. First of all, the concept art was done by Mike Mignola, okay?
Yes, give us this.
He is an amazing artist. Many people know him because he created Hellboy. He's got this style that is very, like, hard black lines, thick, chunky features. Great artist, okay? I'm a sucker for great comic artists.
Yeah.
So I was totally excited. I went to see this in the theater because it was in... He did the concept art. And Disney could have, like, done everything house style. But no, when you watch the movie, you see that inspiration. You see where they've brought in the Mike Mignola style into how they've animated. So the animation is, in my opinion, some of the best animation that Disney's done in a while. It's not overly fraught with digital animation or, you know, the computer, obviously computer stuff. So that's good. Like you pointed out, the voice talent is freaking amazing and the movie doesn't deserve it. I think the comedy starts out strong but fails.
Yeah, I agree. The movie looks really good.
Now, here's where you and I have a conversation like adults. The next year is Treasure Planet.
Yeah.
What I want to bring up is this movie is good concept art, and that, I would guess, because I'm not a part of this Disney world, is what brings in the good voice talent. Mm-hmm. Because I imagine scripts like this evolve, but it's all oral, right? Because you don't illustrate it, because this is Disney we're talking about, so you don't animate it until you have the voices down, mm-hmm. right? Because you wouldn't do it. So you have the animatic, maybe you have the storyboarding, and if you have a world-class storyboarder, and his style is interesting because I've read those comics. It's not like there's a lot of like chiaroscuro shading. It's dark. It's dark contrast between the character and the background, and it's all starkness. And that's why it's interesting. It's almost block done in a way. And we were talking, it's in the fingers. You see it in the fingers and in his jawline. Milo's jawline, especially, you didn't bring this up before, but the way he enunciates is pure. He almost leads with his chin, so much so that when Leonard Nimoy's character dies, and no one gives a shit, but he dies, they put it to a placard, which becomes a stone, which becomes one of the pretending, like the avatars that defend the city, and you still see it. It's that Matt Groening, like you need to see it in silhouette. There's no starker silhouette than one of his silhouettes.
Oh, yes. Like completely.
And so like all the scenes are like a milky gray, like bad, like Daniel sweater or bad polo shirt background. Like, and I say it because it has almost texture of its own against a South Park style paper cutout on front of it with sharp angular angles to it. Every single shot. And that's what's the best part visually.
Yeah.
You know, the CGI turns to shit.
The bad thing is that Disney's hired outside artists before. Like Hercules, they hired Gerald Scarfe, right? The guy who did all of Pink Floyd's animations back in the day. And at the end of the day, though, it just ends up looking like traditional Disney. I think it's the eyes or something. I mean, you're definitely right that this was inspired by Mignola. Thank you. I'm terrible with names, but anyway, you're definitely right. It's inspired by his style, but at the end of the day, I really wish they would have delved fully into it instead of trying to make it look more Disney.
What would be more depressing then? Well, when I was in 5 years ago in New York, they showed that Salvador Dali had done something for Fantasia.
Yes, I remember that.
And he didn't finish it in time, I would say, because of... But...
well, this was back before that even really was a thing, because he's Dali.
He's a hipster. He did it before it was cool.
Wait. Weird pets, terrible facial hair, rich, but spent it all on goofy bullshit. Checks out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a lot, clearly, but... however, they'll reach out to good artists. That doesn't mean it shows up, you know, right? I mean, and that's what we're getting to. I think this movie in particular has hints of something brilliant, but we're in that... I mean, Dismembered 3 is going to come out this week.
All right.
But that just tells you where we are. This is 2001. This is where not only do they not have a home... But this is like the Roomba's discharged, and you have to carry it back to the charger, man. And that's kind of what this movie is. I mean, we can catch up with the plot, but like they get to the edge of Atlantis. Turns out that the military guy they're with is kind of an ass.
Oh, James Garner, you mean?
He's a good character. That's something we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah.
But the only one who knows what movie he's in and is playing it up is James Garner.
Yes.
From the beginning, you know who he's good. The problem is the movie tries to hide that he turns out to be a bad guy. I mean, so...
Because this changes nothing, Nick.
I mean, Olga knows what movie she's in as well, as you were saying, Charlie. But.
I mean, they permanently painted her eyebrows to be evil and always showed her eyes in silhouette. So, You know, to me, that speaks like, oh, she's dark, foreboding, and probably evil.
Yeah, they have her the whole Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS persona the entire time.
Ooh, right? Yikes.
You do. I mean, and it even boils down to dirigibles at the end. Like, this is a steampunk abortion. Like, none of this movie is... I mean, the only character I want to say that is fully developed is Phil Morris plays Dr. Sweet, who I kind of loved by the end. The guy who's built like...
Oh yeah, that dude.
You know, John, I know. We just call him John Henry.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, it's John Henry Irons. I mean, he's the doctor on the voyage. Mm-hmm. He's also kind of halfway to like an osteopath. Like he's cracking necks. He's whatever. Like his character development is that he's married to a Native American and
yeah,
and he patched up some Rough Riders and
well, it's 1914. I mean, his medical training is probably like, here, have some opium and some cocaine. You'll feel better in the morning,
which is true technically, but it won't cure you.
As a professor, you're right. I mean, I have no response.
Yeah, like, they set him up as having been half black, half Native American, and both a medical doctor and someone who's been brought up in the Indian medicine man traditional. They don't really see any of that, him actually using it. Like when he's trying to treat the dying king, he doesn't use any Indian stuff. It's modern Western medicine.
I mean, frankly, he's the only one who gets character development. Like, honestly, he's the only one who's like, hey, we should befriend this poor nerd who's isolated. He's... like he's the only genuine person the whole movie, and he just leaves Movie Town. Like he flies out of Movie Town at the end, and question mark. All of this is question mark.
Now they do give the Puerto Rican mechanic girl some backstory that her father wanted sons and didn't get them, and so he sort of turned his daughter trained one daughter to be a mechanic and the other a boxer.
Yeah.
I
think they trained themselves to be that or something, if I recall correctly.
Okay. I mean, I have it on my screen, but I'm going to scroll around. Here's why I'm going to say you're wrong. What's her name? You can even see all the names on my screen. You have no idea, do you?
I can't remember her name, no.
That's because it's not developed. No one's the only reason I bring up Dr. Sweet, which I remembered, is because there's a dialogue about Sweet. Like, it's a who's on first bit when they're scrolling through a marketplace. The cook is named Cookie. Like, it's an old Western. No one otherwise is developed, other than, of course, Milo. Right? It's all, like, the French guy, the mole, his name is Molière. Would you know that? Who could care? He calls him the mole. Like, it's
wait.
Shit.
So Disney ripped off South Park when they were making this movie.
2001, which came first?
The South Park movie.
Then South Park movie came first. I mean, honestly, like
the better character, by the way, too, in South Park.
It was. The only good characters are John Mahoney as Whitmore, Father Guido Sarducci, whose real name is Don Novello, apparently.
All right.
He's Guido Sarducci. And the other voice actors we talked about. Like, I would rather watch a movie with Michael J. Fox, Don Novello, and, I mean, I don't know, Cookie figuring it out. Because they knew the movie they were in, and they were acting. Like, Slinky Dog is the best. Like, I love Jim Varney. Like, eventually we'll do Ernest Goes to Camp.
Jim Varney's a treasure.
He is.
Hey, Vern.
It's a shame he died. Like, it really is because, I mean, at the age of 50, he smoked himself to death, effectively. But
basically.
He knows who he is. He started out in commercials. He's grateful for the work. So he shows up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, Michael J. Fox and James Garner show up. John Mahoney show up. Everyone else is just waiting for their next Animaniacs callback. I mean, honestly, and I don't begrudge them that, because if I saw the script, I'd be like, I deserve better.
Well, there was this era of late 80s, all through the 90s, where all the stars wanted to be in Disney movies just because it was a status symbol.
That's exactly right. And that's what you see here, where they're not even voice actors. Like, I'd replace half of these people with Jim Cummings just because I know he could act, right? Like, or
Jim Cummings is Winnie the Pooh, right?
And, among other Goofy. Things.
And now he's Goofy as well. Or
G-Shucks.
Paulson. Rob Paulson. who's Yakka Warner, and like
and
two of the Ninja Turtles, and like just because they can do voices, or I mean, Weller.
Oh, Frank Weller?
Frank Welker.
Welker, yes.
Who does every animal ever. Including like, he has 4,000, like, credits. And just because I love Audrey. Audrey's the Puerto Rican character you couldn't think of, but she doesn't deserve to be in this movie. She doesn't care. Like, if it was Rosie Perez, maybe, but it's an actor.
The princess of Atlantis or whatever.
That's Kida.
Oh, Kida, that's right. Who is that?
No one. Young Kida is someone who doesn't exist, and then her name is Cree Summer, who doesn't exist.
Well, she did a lot of voice acting, but she was also in...
according to...
spinoff of The Cosby Show.
Different World?
Yes, A Different World.
According to the Wikipedia, Cree Summer is, in fact, the voice of Elmira from Tiny Toons.
But that's what it is. It's a voice actress, and she's fine. That whole montage where she's like speaking Mayan, and then can also speak Latin, and then Greek, and then Spanish, and then French, and then English, and then you're just like, we wasted 90 seconds to see if she could speak English, which everyone was speaking the whole time.
Yeah, how does that work? They've been underwater for 4,000 years.
So 8, there's a filmmaking premise called bullshit. And sometimes when you need a movie to work, bullshit is what you add. It's like Vaseline when your whole body is chafed and you just need something to calm the fact that no one gives a shit.
At least it's not like Pocahontas where, like, I don't know, love or the wind or colors helped bridge the language gap between Pocahontas and John Smith.
Now,
the director said, I don't understand. What if a tree could say it?
Now, speaking of the Indiana Jones connection, I remember back in the day reading one of those Carl Banks Donald Duck cartoons, you know, when they'd actually go on archaeological adventures. And there was one where Donald and Scrooge go to Atlantis to recover this rare dime. And the explanation there was all languages are derived from Atlantis's language, so they can speak everything, basically.
Well, and to wit, you're not wrong. Here's the thing. I wish that anything about this mattered. I mean, honestly, like, what if when the plot advances, the military guy wants it. They want the heart of Atlantis because the heart of Atlantis is supposed to be a power source. So what if we take it and we could beat the Kaiser or sell it to the Kaiser or question mark because plot.
The only reason they care is because it would kill everybody in Atlantis if they take it.
Because it's also apparently their soul or whatever.
It's the Zardoz crystal computer thing.
And so when they take it, the world starts to end. And when the world starts to end, they're like, well, what if we took it back? And meanwhile, Sex Object has gone up and touched it. And so now she's turned into this crystal woman for no reason, which is not explained.
And then all these native people need, like, their white saviors to come in and show them how to fight back against colonialism and reclaim their culture.
And not only that, we have these amazing technological tools, but if only white people showed up to show us how to use them.
Exactly.
She at one point, Kida, says she's lived for 8,800 years, but never learned how to read.
That's the part that just stuns me, that they all forgot how to, like, use their technology.
What was it? So at one point for Cineprov, I was riffing War Games, and Matthew Broderick at the age of 20 said he never learned how to swim, and that was supposed to be a joke. She's 8,800 years old, and she never knew how to read. Her father, who had been around since the last apocalypse, must know how to read because the last apocalypse, he saved the day when he sacrificed his wife. And he never bothered to teach his daughter, who's 8,800 years old, how to read.
I mean,
that's not a plot problem. That's someone who's just like, f*** it, and then left for lunch early.
That book learning's dangerous for women folk.
That's why I fly the stars and bars every day. I don't have a response to that. Like, you're not wrong.
Speaking of which, wasn't there a line in here, and this takes place in 1914, where Cookie talks about the 37 United States or something.
He does. I have him tattooed on my chest, and he lifts up his shirt to show us.
And was anybody going to tell him that there's 48 at this point?
Also, that maybe Florida's dangling tattoo. A little saggy.
I want to make Rhode Island dance.
I mean, I'll tell you what. That's why Jim Varney wins this movie, because he knows what he's in, and he's like, I'm going to show up and deliver them punchlines.
Hey, Vern.
Hey, Vern. I'm going to make Rhode Island dance. You can't. You have to watch this time.
Hey, Vern, you check out the outfit that princess was wearing?
You were talking about how Larry the Cable Guy was going to... Sorry, Dan Whitney is going to replace him. Hey, cool.
Oh, cool, Vern.
Hey, cool, Vern.
You farted, Vern.
Jesus. Oh, wait, shit. I farted. Anyone got some extra drawers? Hey, cool.
God.
I hate Jim.
Damn.
I hate all of them. That's why we miss Jim Varney, man. Because when Ernest goes to camp, you care when the bullies beat him up. You care when he saves Christmas. I mean, no one cares when he went to Africa because...
Yeah.
Ooh, stay tuned.
No.
The importance of being Ernest. Next year, we'll do a month called The Importance of Being Ernest.
There you go.
That would be a good idea.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so Jim Varney.
Oscar gone wild. Yeah, no. Jesus Christ. Anyway... The movie ends. The military guys try to steal it. They end up stealing some flying fishities. And if
James Garner gets turned into a crystal and shattered?
Yeah, he William Shatners himself.
Well, also, Helga dies somehow, but I forget how.
He throws her off the thing.
Yeah, Garner throws him, and then actually Helga's the one who saves the day because everyone else is kind of impotent at this point.
And she's somehow still alive and shoots a flare gun at it.
Yeah.
Blows up the dirigible.
Yeah, I mean, but like dirigible is like quote unquote question mark. Last week we talked about Area 51. This is like one of those weather balloons that crashed with people aboard. Like this thing is, regardless, at the end of all of this, those crystals have the MacGuffin of healing people, but they can't heal the dying king.
Well, at that point, the crystal had been taken away, I think.
No, they had one. They were rubbing it over him. It's just, Dr. Sweet goes, internal bleeding. There's nothing I can do. Everyone has a crystal. Everyone in the village has a crystal.
I thought at that point, the crystals were they think it's some juice in them because they could turn the machines on.
They do.
But I thought they were all dying out because the big one was gone.
But clearly
but
it's
that's not explained.
Nothing is
explained. It's inconsistent.
Everything is inconsistent. But like you said, everyone in town has one. And in fact, we know that it heals because not only does it heal Mile early in the movie, but every single person gets one. Like even our heroes get one, and they use it to prevent dying. Because at one point, when they're having the full-out battle, we see one of the flying fish things get shot down. The guy falls and then walks away.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to have a plot device to have Leonard Nimoy die because, oh my God, if he'd shot out of a torpedo tube.
Because like,
oh,
he falls down and has spontaneous bagpipes. Bleeding. I mean, there's no explanation for that.
There's no explanation for anything.
Oh, well, no, that's true.
I mean, hold on to your hat.
I thought it was because Colonel A-hole decked him while weighing him by about 200 pounds.
Yeah, I mean. We've all taken a punch before, but, like, that doesn't end magic. This movie is based in magic. I hate to tell you, but whatever. The movie ends with a anticlimactic fight scene on top of a dirigible.
And then good guys win. Milo decides he's going to stay behind with Kida. Everyone else goes back home.
With a lot of money.
Yeah, with a lot of money.
With a lot of money, yeah.
They're loading it up with gold. I will say, a legitimate laugh I got is at that end scene where, like, everyone is decked out. Even Mole Man is like...
They're all wearing their fancy clothes. And how did this end again? And what happened to this person? He's looking at all the pictures. That was actually really cute.
Yeah, like, because the thing is, Whitmore kind of gets it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everyone, like... Even Mole Man has like a cravat with a diamond stud, and Jim Varney is like as Cookie is actually telling the truth of what happened. Everyone's shutting him up. Father Guido Sarducci with his literally flat skull. It's very the yeah. first season of The Critic. Is like, you know, we tried to save people, but he just didn't make it out alive. He went down with the sub. And he like has a diamond stud in his tooth. Like, everyone gets it. Like, that's the one, like, closed-door farce. It's the best. That's the scene that makes it. Because we have all those voice characters I wanted in a room together getting it. It's the best.
Yeah, but, I mean, at the end of the day, what does it all mean?
The movie ends. It doesn't bother.
All right.
I mean, honestly, it doesn't. It just, like... Milo's down there. The sequel is called Milo Returns, which means at one point he leaves. We don't see it.
They, I think they were supposed to have a TV show that they canceled because it didn't make enough money. So they glued together three episodes that would have been a TV show to make a direct-to-video sequel.
And what is it? You Milo look that Return. Much up.
It takes place apparently during the Depression, so Milo's been down there for like 15 years.
Yeah, but why would he return? Does he return to Earth?
Yeah.
So you take away the most... Oh, my God.
There was
so
a bunch of stuff involving other ancient artifacts, and I didn't really read it that closely.
Thanks, Wikipedia. So...
I think it was IMDb.
Even worse. That means it was submitted by fans. Fans of this. Ew. Ew.
Oh, come on. It's not that bad.
I thought it was entertaining.
Here's the thing about it, though. It's passionless.
You're right.
I mean, yeah. like, Disney, it's impossible for Disney to put out a movie worse than a C because it's all producers, it's thought crime. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
it's creationless in only insofar as it's produced to death. Like, there's so many people who've done good things around them to say, well, what if you did this, 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 this? It's at its best when there's someone with an idea up front. This was clearly something where no one had an idea, so they strung it together with other things, right? That's its biggest problem.
I would say the biggest crime of this movie is that it wasn't a G movie and it didn't have songs, which is why it flopped.
It could have even had a good score and that would have been okay in lieu of songs. I mean, the score that they had was okay.
I mean, but you know what? Frankly, if I had my druthers, it's Disney. Make this live action, right?
Yeah,
it's not great animated because the animation should add something, but it doesn't. They could have in 2002 done this live action in a way that would have felt like something. This just feels so ethereal. There's nothing really to look at. Yeah. All the character designs are fine. They don't do anything with it. Anyway, let's wrap this up. Daniel, why don't you give us yours?
I don't know. I didn't really enjoy it while I was watching it, and I didn't really think the animation was all that special either. It was just a whole lot of nothing for me. The phrase that we've come back to time and time again is designed by committee, which is so true in this case. This really does feel... like a project that had to meet a deadline rather than any sort of artistic vision. I mean, it's Disney kind of at its worst, really.
Yeah. Charlie?
I think it started off with a good concept. It had some great initial art. The animation, I still think, was pretty good. They took the house style. They inched it towards, you know, Mignola's style. It was beautiful. I liked it. I think that its failings was that it tried to be a kid's movie at the beginning, and then it turned and got a little too adult.
Yeah.
And I think that probably the committee was fighting over what to keep in and what not to keep in, because it did get a PG rating. And for Disney movies, for animated Disney movies, that's like the kiss of death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think it had the potential to be something great, but Disney's not fond of taking chances with their animation.
Nope. Nailed it. Yep. Matt?
Time for some heresy. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was entertaining and pretty funny. I mean, Nick talks about how great the voice cast is. Maybe that's what saved it for me, because I like these people.
I think my interaction with it is kind of in between a bunch of you. I don't... hate this movie. I'm just bored by it. It, like, not a lot happens. My charm for it lights up when some of the people I like talk. It doesn't even matter what they say oftentimes. It's just that they are committed much more. This movie just, it feels like wet fart. Like, there's nothing happens. It's just nothing. And that's what bothers me the most of all. There's clearly money here. It clearly looks okay. They clearly had CGI budget in a time when CGI was expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's not even CGI. It's good-looking CGI. I mean, like, it's at least seamless CGI. Mm. So what does it mean to me? It just means that it had no direction. This might be one of the worst directed movies we've shown. In a weird way. Not because we haven't done movies with bad directors, but when there's been bad directors in the past, it's all been bad. Right?
Yeah.
This movie feels like the directors were the worst part. Right? Like,
wow.
They were like, well, let's stumble on to the next scene.
Michael Bay directed this. No, not really.
Right. I mean, if it was Michael Bay and Roland Emmerich, you would have been like, yeah, right. Like, this is their first role, right? Like, they almost got it. They're almost there. But this feels even, like, less than that. It feels almost like a bad commercial at times, right? Like, it feels like one of those interstitials for Cartoon Network.
Yeah.
Like, because the in-between stuff feels like it's just like, let's have a monologue where everyone gives like 10 minutes. Like, it's like, everyone talk about your past in like a tight five. And so there's this one scene where, like, for 10 minutes, no one just says anything other than, well, one time I was in a circus and that circus made me sad. Like, I don't know. Like, this movie had more potential than it was worth, and everyone showed up except for the scripts and the direction. This is the opposite of every movie we've ever done.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
You are not wrong.
Anyway, so I'm looking forward to the According to Quinn review, where it's like 6.5 stars.
I think I gave it an 8.
Out of 10, by the way. He's got a 10-point scale.
So I know what I'm buying you for Christmas. A DVD copy of a better movie.
Ooh, DVD.
The DVD. Anyway, so after this, he's not here because he knew better. Thomas is leading us into a Muppety month.
Ooh.
And so because we love Jim Henson here, I will switch over.
So because I love Jim Henson and all of his creations, we're going to do a month of Jim Henson-y movies, ending with possibly my favorite Jim Henson movie of all time, which is A Muppet Christmas Carol, which will come out right around the Christmas season. However, we're going to start with the movie that at least three of my female friends told me entered them into their womanhood, which is Labyrinth, because nothing is better than when a Bowie gives you a bulge. So stay tuned next week and every future week. We put a little notch in your belt. I mean, put a little piece of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
Myopia Defender Childhood is hosted by Nick Hoffman, edited by Candace Burns, and executive produced by Nick Hoffman and Candace Burns. It is produced by Daniel Suttis, Matthew Quinn, and Thomas Herman. We are a proud member of the ESO Network and a product of Good Letter Podcast. Our theme is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod, minded at inpumptech.com. It is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3 license. And thanks.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.